I love kind of going through this series of lexicon of like kind of like within world building and kind of sourcing queer history and sort of and mashing it and pairing it and then following what comes out. And so within the work that I'm making, I'm trying to build upon these symbols of history. And so referencing the AIDS Memorial Quilt or referencing the scarecrows or ghosts, these all have a connection towards queer history. And so part of that, I think, in my work, I often try to push the boundaries of what I think necessarily a ghost or a scarecrow or an angel could look like, and just playing with that and allowing for multiplicity in the work. And they become, I think, like a cast of characters that inhabit this place. And, you know, I have a vision of them all living together in one space.
Welcome to the Studio Break Podcast. I'm your host, David Linaway. For today's 324th episode, I'm super excited to be joined by Eric Anthony Burtis, who is a mixed media artist that uses lots of found fabric and repurposes them into self-sculptures and installations. We talk all about their work, which explores ideas of queer history, queer theory, activism, and that's all coming up. Of course, we do want to highlight their current two-person exhibition that's up right now through July 27th at Grizzly Grizzly in Philadelphia. The show is called Entity Cramming, and it also features works by Soso Capaldi. I do want to encourage you to follow Eric Anthony Burtis on Instagram, and of course, check out their website, ericanthonyburtis.com. Eric's feature on Cedar Break is part of our 2023 professional competition juried by Jeff Stevenson, so we're excited to include him in the Studio Break archive. If you're new to Cedar Break, please check out the website, cedarbreak.com. We've got a bunch of podcasts that you can check out in our archive. Great for studio listening. Each of our posts there have images of the artist's work, links to their websites. You can listen right there on cedarbreak.com, or you can subscribe in Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, which comes out every so often to let you know about new podcasts, opportunities, and exhibitions. I currently have Saccharine Dreams, which is a solo exhibition of my paintings that's up through July 5th at Studio Break Gallery. You can check out the gallery tab to see some works that are available there. I'm really excited about our Studio Break Invitational show, which opens July 12th and was curated by Mark Mitchell from the University of Arkansas. Super excited to have him on board to select all these great artists that include April Beinecke, Harvey Bayless, Amelia Carley, Jeffrey Cortland Jones, Raina Frankel, Jody Hayes, Lily Hollanden, Rachel Hausman Shaw, Toby Kaufman Buhler, Amanda Lechner, Katie Neese, Nikki Painter, Anthony Parkasic, Abby Peters, Jolene Powell, Rachel Prinz, Chris Schultz, Rachel Simonsky, Yair Sikowski, and Megan Wolfkill. It's also going to overlap the same night that the Main Street Gallery in West Chicago has the opening for the Impressions print show, which features over 20 artists as well. That's 5 minutes from Studio Break Gallery. So it's a pretty cool two-for-one exhibition night, which ends with the Studio Break Invitational at Studio Break Gallery on July 12th. So mark your calendars and come on out and see the show. As always, like our Facebook page and follow us on Instagram at studio_break. And let's get right into this episode with Eric Anthony Burtis. Stay tuned. Welcome to Studio Break, Eric Anthony Burtis. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. You know, it's exciting to finally have you on. As we've been kind of talking, you were selected as one of our pro competition a couple of years ago back in 2023 by Jeff Stevenson, who's a great artist and, again, part of that community here. So excited to have you on the podcast to feature your work. So thanks again for taking the time.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, well, again, as we're kind of getting started, I would just kind of remind people, you know, you can check out Eric's work. It's same thing for Instagram, right? So people can go check that out. And, you know, there's going to be lots to talk about. So, you know, I know that I've gotten a little bit of a preview of this, but remind everybody, where did you grow up? And, you know, we can kind of like snake forward from there into talking about all the shows and stuff that you have going on now.
Great. Hi, my name's Eric Anthony Burtis. I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, which is near the Great Lakes. And I reside in State College, Pennsylvania, Central PA, in the middle.
In the middle, right on. And, you know, you were talking about, you know, your
doctorate candidate right now, or doctoral candidate and teacher, and we've been talking about that, and obviously a maker too. So when did that all start? I would imagine for some reason you're somebody that's been always kind of creative and interested in making things, but I have no idea.
I have a twin brother. His name's Alex. And Alex and I, our favorite place growing up was down the street from my home called Grandma's House. And my grandma, Sue McDaniels, at the time, has always been just grandma to me. But in a prior life, she was an art teacher. And so she often brought her creativity and love of art and kind of space to make in her home. And so she had this like section of her closet that we used as a place to store our work and supplies. And when we were done with our homework after school, we would, you know, get things out and we would draw pictures and build and, you know, always saving toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls and going through scotch tape like a crazy person and just kind of allowing for that time to make. I appreciated that growing up. And my brother and I, we often look back at those moments fondly as we spent time at grandma's house.
Sure.
You know, on the dining room table.
Well, it's nice to think that all that material exploration started really early, you know, and I can appreciate it too. I mean, it's interesting, like the kind of stuff that will turn into something, especially as we're kids, you know, anything that you can kind of use to make something. And was it kind of, I'm assuming not super specific, I'm assuming you kind of did everything with making, but were you studying like art in school eventually, or like in grade school, or?
In elementary school there, I think there was a divide. I think there was like, you know, the children's media influence of like battle scenes that we would create. And then, you know, going to school and kind of learning about the real Western canon of artists, like, you know, Van Gogh. And as I kind of navigated school, I was lucky enough to be able to get into art classes. I think a lot of schools that there's not enough art classes for students. And so I was able to get in a pathway to take them. And so I remember visiting, we took a day trip to the Cleveland Museum of Art, which is a free museum, but I felt so like I could see myself there, you know, I could see myself like having the, and I think that was in, you know, early part of my life. And so that I think gave me the kick in the pants to pursue it in college. And I think also having a family member that had made it her career and studied it also was a pathway for me and my brother. My brother is a graphic designer. He also has a BFA. I ultimately decided to pursue art education at Slip Rock University, and I'm like wearing their sweater right now. but Slip Rock is in Western Pennsylvania, kind of in between Erie and Pittsburgh. And so it was far enough away to be myself, but it was close enough to be home if I needed to, if I got homesick. And I think being at Slippery Rock, I was able to, you know, embrace my own leadership and identity and, you know, I think come out as a queer person and find community that way. And that wasn't something that I necessarily was exploring in my artwork, but I think like exploring in my leadership and exploring in my friendships and community, I think that kind of led me to, you know, further pursuits, which then when I moved to Philadelphia after Slippery Rock, being in this rural area, there was an explosion of, you know, queer community and history, and that all really shaped my career. And so I feel like I, when I left undergrad, I just felt like I was constantly continuing to learn. And and yeah, Philly was a really wonderful and transformative space of artists and queer people and social justice movements. And so it was just a really wonderful eye-opening experience to kind of like live out my 20s and
sure. Yeah, totally. Well, again, I mean, I remember telling somebody, I think like in college, I'm here to find out who I am, or it sounds like an opportunity to do all those things and to be part of something and, you know, figure out what you're invested in. And you tell me, what was it like in terms of kind of studying to be an art teacher, but then also being an artist yourself? Were you making work and all that stuff?
Yeah. So at Slippery Rock, it feels very unique, but we have a BFA program as well. And then it's a teaching certification program. And so very heavy on the art. And then I would say like it's supplemented and supported with education courses. And so my foundation, I think, was very rich in kind of like a general BFA experience, but I didn't necessarily like gravitate, I think, towards like a media when I first entered. I think I was like, oh, I don't know, there's all these studios and what can I take? And then someone who I was friends with, she was a senior and she had her exhibition in fibers. And so I was like, oh, I don't know what fibers is, like fabrics. You know, I had this very naive thinking about it. And when I saw her work, it was like a blend of her name's Sam Ditch, Sam Morin. She's an amazing person and lives in Pittsburgh. And shout out to Sam. Her work, it was a blend of installation and photography and painting and drawing and all of these things that I loved. And I was just like, oh, this is a home for me. Like, and this just kind of became a way in which I work. Within that, I kind of like learned, I think, having a more material history of work instead of a art historical background. And so that started to have me look towards, you know, these, I would say, like, they're more prevalent now, but I think looking at women's history and the women and feminist movements, as well as the queer movements of art and the separation of craft and art, and kind of really diving into those through fibers, and kind of pushed me throughout my career. And I ended up doing a post-bac at Tyler School of Art in their fiber and craft and material studies program. And then I ended up going to Virginia Commonwealth for my master's in fiber and craft and material studies also. And so learning and being a teacher throughout the way was always a part of my perhaps navigation. I don't come from a family that has a lot of money. And so what are you going to do with that was always art. What are you going to do with that was always a like something in the back of my mind and something, a conversation that I was having with people. And so I was always like, oh, I'm going to be a teacher. And so, you know, I took the standard classes. And when I entered the job market, I started in Philadelphia. I couldn't find a job in art education, but because they needed teachers, I became a reading teacher. And, you know, so I spent the first few years of my teaching career, you know, teaching myself how to teach reading. And so that, I don't think that was set up for success the best way, but invited me to kind of, I think, be more creative in my approach to work and allow children to kind of like follow their interest and connect to stories in different ways than just like, this is the plot, this is the summer, you know? So, and you know, looking at illustrations and kind of how these, I would just say, like, I think I had a blend of different things that kind of went along the way.
You know, I guess, you know, kind of give us an idea of like maybe, you know, when you first kind of started making stuff that you were feeling hit a little bit differently than maybe stuff that we make early on. You know, I feel like when we start out, we're almost like imitating something, and then we might find inspiration or just find something that, yeah, just hits a little closer to home. You feel a little bit more present in the work. Is there anything that kind of stands out to you, like a time where you're like, oh, this is like, I kind of have something here?
I think like within my undergrad experience, I just think I was kind of like learning a lot of processes. And then when I got into my post-bac, I was given a studio and I was like, I've never had one of these. I was making art in my bedroom. And so like it was a shared communal space. And so there was something about like, you know, being able to lock the door and like, you know, try things out and like listen to music really loud, or like I think like, and just play and experiment and kind of like follow a groove that was just different than like needing to like also like clean up afterwards, or like, if that makes sense. And so being able to have that like dedicated space, I think, was just a really phenomenal experience, because in the past it had just been given to graduate students, but because of this timeline, I was able to have a studio, and it was just so wonderful to kind of be able to experiment with video and just create in a different way. And so I think like entering fibers, I started to make a lot of videos that were in props for performances. And so just kind of doing like repetitive acts and things. And then And I created a series of videos that went out into the world, and someone gave me the suggestion, like, oh, you should perform live. Like, you should really, like, break away from the camera. And that I took a performance class and kind of was allowing me to, like, put all these ideas together. And so in, I think, 2017, way back when, almost 10 years ago, I created this character that I called Friend, or the Friend of Gender Equality. And he was kind of looking at a lot of theory and queer theory and kind of exploring this, but he was my version of a failed superhero. And so this superhero character just constantly was pathetic and effeminate and was these opposite mannerisms of what we ideal as, like, a, you know, the classical masculine superhero. And the mask that he wore didn't have eye holes. And so I was also, like, visually impaired and couldn't really see what I was doing and, like, fumbling and babbling and just, like, the total opposite of what a superhero would be. But, you know, I had the classic underwear on the outside of my clothes, humorful play. And this opened up a wide variety of avenues to think about installation and the props that kind of went on with the performance. And so Friend kind of became this, like, conduit to kind of explore, like, these really hard themes. You know, I think navigating what it means to be queer as, you know, a 20-year-old, 20-something-year-old, and kind of, like, the rememory that happens when you're bullied and that. So there was a series of performances that I did that was kind of, like, navigating my childhood. And so every superhero, I think, needs a trusty sidekick. And so mine was a hobby horse or a stick pony that I would ride. And this just was very absurd in a lot of ways. And all of this work, I think, was connected towards art history and different theorists that I was, and performance artists that I was thinking about. And as I was kind of, like, coming up to these theorists and performance artists, I was just constantly shocked and of, like, the roadblocks or the dead ends that were, like, in their lives. And I just kept coming up to, like, oh, Lee Bowery, they died of AIDS. Like, oh, the Coquettes, like, amazing performance troupe in San Francisco, many of them died of AIDS. And so just thinking about this, as well as, like, you know, Keith Haring, also, anyway, so just thinking about all these artists that I was like, they died of AIDS, they died of AIDS. And so this got me navigating these, like, inquiries of, like, what would their ghosts look like? Or what would something, you know, I didn't have an answer. I just knew that I don't necessarily think that they would be a white cotton bedsheet that we see at Halloween time. I think that they would be more full of life and love in a way. And so I also started to create, you know, more sculptures, and I didn't really know what I was going to do with them, but I created one. And I was just kind of playing in my studio and, like, figuring things out and, like, trying different things. One night I had an Afghan that was, my studio was cold. And so I would often wear the Afghan blanket as, like, you know, to keep warm. But one night I cut eye holes in a smiley face into it, and I draped it over the ghost. And because of the way the gravity of cloth works, the smiley face became this, like, sag or a scream. And I was immediately triggered to the portrait of Felix Parts by A.A. Bronson, which is a billboard-sized portrait that A.A. Bronson did of Felix Parts. And it's 3 hours after his death of AIDS-related complications. And so in this portrait, it's taken after death portraiture, but in this portrait, he is emaciated from his illness, and he is surrounded in all of these blankets and in these different colors, and has this tape recorder. And the sagging of my Afghan blanket on my sculpture kind of became this, like, almost like a death portraiture. And so instead of a smile, it became this, like, almost like a scream or similar what happens when your face relaxes when you die. And so in those, like, I think in those moments of play and kind of just allowing myself to be in a safe space and, you know, not having to worry about just kind of escaping from, I think, the day-to-day and in my studio, I was able to kind of, like, create this work in some way, and maybe not in the best meandering straightforward shot. It took a lot of failure and a lot of trial and error, but that was, like, I think how I kind of came to it. And making that ghost, I was like, oh, I have to make another one. I have to make another one. And I've always worked in series, but it started allowing me to think through this world that I was building.
Yeah, it's super exciting, you know, to think about, especially the way that it was able to kind of connect with your identity, who you are, what you're interested in, and kind of moving beyond something that was just, I guess, surface level. And I don't feel too bad in terms of some of my notes, even, because there's a playfulness, or, you know, you start thinking, I think you have pieces that kind of reference forts, or, you know, I think of quilts or old blankets and nostalgia and being a kid. So, I mean, there's a playful aspect to it, but then, there, you know, like obviously the content is something that can kind of become more serious or, you know, shift, you know, depending on the context. And, you know, I guess I'm, you know, kind of interested too, as, you know, somebody that's a maker, then, like, you know, did you start, I guess, kind of conceptualizing things in advance? Or, you know, I notice, for example, like there's so many different materials that you use. Are you somebody that you kind of have to like start playing with these materials to kind of start forming a picture in your head of maybe what you want to do with them?
Yeah, I think for me, that is like the crux of things. Things often sit and they will, like, I'll live with them for a long time. And I just kind of returned to having my studio in my home again. For a long time, I was renting a space and I would have to drive to, or I was able to have access through an institution. I recently decided that I would have space in my home. And so it's been interesting to kind of think about living with these materials again and living with these objects and how they can inform my view. And so some things I'll try or I'll test out, and then they'll sit for months, and then I will try something else, and then I'll kind of return to them. And then by proximity and luck and chance, I'm sitting next to, they're sitting next to each other in my studio, or I put them in the same box and I open that box up again, and I'm like, oh, those two things work together. Now it's time to put them together. And I do think sometimes having a deadline of a show or an exhibition helps, because I can try things out and have a space to try things out and, you know, play with form and shape and when I'm installing, that I can't really do in my studio. And so I think that crunch of a deadline does help. But I think through the act of just like going in the studio and making, and going in the studio and having a task, I think invites or elicits those excitements. And so with quilting and like other fiber-based processes, there's often just this like mundane repetition that needs to happen, whether it's like stitching or embroidering or sequining something. And it's just like, I'm going to sequin the top of this blanket and I need to just put sequins on it. I can listen to an audiobook or I can watch Netflix, you know, but it's this ask of just doing it. And that is, I think, part of it for me. And just being able to get into the studio and making allows for that space to calm down and also, like, you know, heal myself and, like, you know, disassociate from the political climate or whatever, and just like,
sure,
like I'm present in this, in making this world that I'm building.
We're taking a quick coffee break to remind you to head on over to cedarbreak.com and check out some of the podcasts that you missed. We have over 300 episodes in our archive, great for studio listening. Each of our posts there have images of the artist's work, links to their websites, and you can listen right there on cedarbreak.com, or consider subscribing at Spotify or Apple. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, which comes out every so often to let you know about new podcasts, opportunities, and exhibitions. Saccharine Dreams, which is my solo exhibition, runs through July 5th. You can also come out to our next opening on July 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. The Studio Break Invitational features over 20 artists from all around the country. The show is curated by Mark Mitchell, so we're excited to bring it all together. It's also coinciding the same night that Main Street Gallery in West Chicago, 5 minutes away, will feature over 20 print-based artists from around the country as well. So coming out for a double show July 12th. And of course, you can follow along by liking our Facebook page or following us on Instagram at studio_break. And now that my coffee is all topped off, let's get right back to the episode with Eric Anthony Burtis.
I'm especially curious too. I mean, obviously, because I see so much in terms of material, like maybe tell us about some processes and things that you, I know a little bit, for example, about VCU, in the sense that there's, from what I understand, just tons of different facilities for making. And imagine like part of your interest too in studying fabric and working with fabric so long. There's, you know, all these different techniques that you might pull from. And as somebody that, you know, is looking at as somebody that has no background in all of this, I don't necessarily know like how much of all of this is like made. How do you source it? Like, are you using like found fabrics? Are you going to Joann Fabrics? Sorry.
Rest in peace, Joann Fabrics.
Right. I feel bad.
I made a conscious decision, I think, early on in my career that I was going to try to limit my purchase of fabrics because there was all of these fabrics in the world that you could purchase secondhand or acquire through other means. And so oftentimes I source and navigate like thrifted items or consignment store items. And many of these things once lived at Joann's, but I typically buy secondhand, or I'm lucky enough that being a boy who often works in textiles, someone in my neighborhood finds out that I like to sew, and then they will give me their collection of things or their grandmother's collection of things. And so that was happening a lot during the pandemic. Was I was often acquiring things
Sure.
that were once, you know, in someone else's craft closet. But my interest starting at VCU, I entered in through a fibers program, and my knowledge was kind of coming from like fabric as surface. And so there's a strong tradition of weaving. I love weaving, but that was just not my part of, it's not a part of my studio practice currently, but I'm often thinking about like the fabric as a surface material. And so dyeing the fabric or stitching on top of the fabric and manipulating those methods rather than building the cloth. And so I entered through kind of a dyeing, stitching, and printing. And all of those have kind of become ways in which I work. And then through the history, the queer history that I was kind of looking through, I fell in love with the Names Project or the AIDS Memorial Quilt. That took over the Washington Mall. And so that became another aspect of my work. And so I was like, oh, I should learn to quilt and connect with that method. And so you kind of mentioned forts before. And so although my quilts are not necessarily, you know, beautiful pieces that just sit on the wall, they become other things. I think about how textiles can take up space in different ways. And I use a lot of like, I think, child led inquiry to, or thinking about like, what would my inner child do? And constructing forts seems like a level of that. And so using found wood and other structures to kind of like create this thing, the ghosts in a lot of ways kind of have this like fort-like appearance in them. But yeah, I think also the quilting also allowed for the work to kind of have this like richer sag to them. When it was just like a piece of fabric draped, it had this like lightness or this airiness. And when it became quilted, it immediately is, you know, more than a single layer of fabric. It's sometimes three or more with the batting inside and the top layer and the back layer. And so that just made the object heavier. And so this just had a different weight to the work than necessarily just like one bed sheet. But fabric, we all have a very intimate relationship to fabric. We're all wearing it. It's touching our clothes. It's in crevices of our body, and our body is staining. My armpits are staining my t-shirt right now because I'm sweating. And bed sheets have an immediate connection because, you know, we sleep on them, we stretch them out. And so used bed sheets at the thrift store are like so rich in stains and material history, and there's elements of it being worn that, because they've already existed in someone's life that someone then donated, even when they're washed, they still hold these memories. And even though they're not my memories, although many of the clothes I sometimes will recycle into my work are my memories, I love that material richness that comes with like an older used bed sheet that I then will dye and treat and stitch on top of. But those things, you know, are a part of the work. And thrifting it is just an easier way to kind of get that history without me having to live with something. So a lot of the clothes that are in the work are some things that don't fit me anymore, or I've had to buy bigger clothes. You know, I think like many people during COVID. like we got the clothes got more comfy.
Sure, sure.
But
It's so interesting to me because it's literally almost the same conversation I had for this podcast about collage, that we were talking about that, and they were saying almost the same thing. Like, there's all of this media in the world, there's all of this fabric, there's all of these stories, there's all this history, and it's interesting to think about the way that you can kind of combine those into new experiences, or essentially set them up to kind of talk about your experience. And I'm, again, just super interested in the way that you kind of do that. As somebody that is very invested in color, even though maybe my palette can be a little bit muted, that's something that I feel like I recognize in your work, is just like the love of color. Is that something that might set off like a, like a start to something? You just see something that pops, or maybe something where you're starting to kind of see a couple of things resonate potentially, and it's like, what happens if I start sewing this together or putting this together? Or
yeah, someone in grad school was like, "Are you colorblind?" Because they just were like, they didn't, they just were, they had so many questions about my choices. And I think that's one thing that I love about textiles is you can make quick decisions and there comes a solid, like a solidifying when it's stitched, but there's so many other factors that happen before that, whether it's arranging or mapping or, and then there's some fun, there's some just some straight fun when you put something in the dye bath and you pull it out and you're like, ooh, like I think tie-dye elicits to that. And so I always try to include, I think like the quick thrills or the cheap thrills in those like material like loves of tie-dye. Like there's nothing better. I've been doing it for almost 15 years now, and I still love to see what happens when when you undo a resist or something. But I think the arranging of things allows me to work through a series of ideas. And a lot of the time I think I'm sourcing things from my experience. And so as like a preschool teacher or, a kindergarten teacher, those were like aspects of my work that I haven't lost. And so like it's like I'm very influenced by, the saturated bright colors. But I think part of that is coming out in the work in some ways. And so it's always fun when people bring their kids to my things, because their kids, like, they always are like, your show was my favorite. And like, audience, thank you. But I think there's this like trick that happens in the work where I invite them through these, hyper saturated and embellished things, and then there's a twist that happens and folks continue to go, oh, like there's something sad here, or there's something else here that I think tricks them. And so that has been a part of, I think, the work from the beginning. And color is a way, and the glamour of the sequins is a way that I think catches people and allows for that trick to happen in the viewing.
Again, I'll kind of keep plugging it. EricAnthonyBurtis.com. You can see there's a huge portfolio of different work. And, I'm especially interested because you're making these soft sculptures, installations. I would imagine a lot of this comes about like you're just bringing a bunch of stuff to a space and kind of seeing what resonates. Or are you very like specifically like, oh no, these are the pieces that are going to be in this show? Or tell us how that works. And obviously we'll be talking a little bit about your exhibition, as well, to kind of maybe outline that. But
I mean, again, I think I mentioned I work in series, and so sometimes I try to push, I kind of like I resonate with an idea or a theme. And so I had mentioned the ghost before, but most recently I was thinking about scarecrows. And as you may or know, I Matthew Shepard was a young gay man who was walking home, and he was brutally attacked. And when his body was found, it appeared to, initially someone saw it and they thought it was a scarecrow. And then they went back and they realized it was him and he needed to go to the hospital. And so that story and that legacy and that connection had me like kind of following this like inquiry of like scarecrows. And, I went to like looking at, the Wizard of Oz and like thinking about like The Wizard of Oz, the Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow, and that collection. And that's often, they're known as the Friends of Dorothy, which is a term that was often given to someone who perhaps was effeminate or queer as a slur, but then also became this like reclaiming or this way in which someone might out themselves or like be like, oh, they're a friend of Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
They're a part of the community. And so like, I love kind of going through this, like, I think this series of lexicon of like kind of like within world building and kind of sourcing queer history and sort of and mashing it and pairing it and then following what comes out. And so within the work that I'm making, I'm trying to build upon these symbols of history. And so referencing the AIDS memorial quilt or referencing the scarecrows or ghost, these all have a connection towards queer history. And so part of that, I think in my work, I often try to push the boundaries of what I think necessarily a ghost or a scarecrow or an angel could look like, and just playing with that and allowing for multiplicity in the work. And they become, I think, like a cast of characters that inhabit this place. And, you know, I have a vision of them all living together in one space, but I'm slowly becoming that these things are going to have to be digital because some pieces get recycled and become and return back to one another. And so that's like some things become something else. And I just kind of love that entanglement or that becoming of something becoming something else that is like, that's happening in the work right now. And yeah. And so I'm enjoying that aspect of returning to a piece and breaking it up and compiling it back together for something else.
Yeah. Awesome. Again, I'm pumped because in my notes, I wrote down figurative and, you know, that's one of the things that I think about with your work and, you know, being able to kind of walk around it. They like, it totally makes sense because it's like they're characters, they're, you know, people, they're stand-ins, they're something that make you kind of aware of your space. And maybe that's why children especially, you know, flock to it, aside from the color, but there's that interaction that is different and certainly less static than just looking at something in a white cube on a wall, you know, or something like that, you know, kind of allows us participation from people that are going to kind of experience it. And as I've been kind of alluding to it, I don't know, why don't you tell us a little about the show that you have that's, I think, going on very shortly, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So I was asked to have a two-person show at Grizzly Grizzly with my friend Soso, and we kind of like resonated on play in our work. Soso has kind of like often used like game kind of style drawings of like connect the dots and things. And I've often used play as like a source of my work. And we kind of were laughing about children that we have worked with and like babysat and like kind of worked with and their love of Minecraft and this idea of entity cramming, which is like a method in Minecraft that like where someone like compiles a bunch of the same thing into one spot and then it breaks open and then like unleashes a magnitude of things in a very maximal setting. And so we were thinking about this as a way of entity cramming of these ideas. And so using repetition and using play to kind of explore that through an installation. And so we have never shown together. We were we were suggested by the curator to meet and we just became fast friends and, you know, a love of the internet and to kind of like talk about play in childhood. And so I'm interested to see how this work will come together. But in my work, I am kind of using a lot of repetition and form and to kind of play with forms of the body and kind of expanding on that idea of a scarecrow again. But so there's like evidence of a body, but they are abstract in a lot of ways. And so you might see hands with no legs or a body without organs in some ways. And so so there's this material, I guess, material density and material play that's going on between both of our work. But yeah, that's kind of it.
And you said you had installed already. How did that go?
We're installing next week, but okay. We have been shooting. We've been kind of chit-chatting and kind of playing with, you know, images, digital images, and sharing with each other to kind of like as we kind of work.
And it's always hard to see stuff in a space. And I know, you know, even when you were talking earlier about some of those experiences studying, you know, I think it sounded cliche at the time where people would be like, oh, you'll never be in this situation again with all these people. And certainly you think about that with like not having the same studio that you might have had at some point where, again, you could just leave it a mess and, you know, you're around all these other artists. What's it like then, too, to kind of be making these works that are very physical, you know, in a space where you might not be able to see them? Is that kind of like, again, part of the fun when you have like an opportunity like this? Because you're going to, again, bring all the stuff that you've been making, I'm assuming, but then it's got to change that context a little bit when you see it and see the way that it resonates with the other artist's work.
I will say, I have always worked modularly. So one beautiful thing about fabric is it can fold up. I think one of the limitations I faced in grad school, which I'm so grateful that I had, was it had to get through the door. And so I had to think about ways in which the work could get through the door and also get packed into my Honda Fit, because I don't have a big car. And so, and so the beauty of fabric is it gets folded up and can get put into a container and, you know, shot and vacuum sealed if it needs to. So then when it gets to the gallery, it can balloon back up and unfold in these ways. And so that's a part of the work that I love, is this kind of like the reliving or the reshelving of the work. And so there is an element of surprise with install, but I think having a plan and I think having experience in installing and kind of getting those opportunities to like go big in grad school, go big in use in DIY spaces. And so, you know, taking risks and, you know, some of my favorite art is made in garages, and these spaces that we don't often look in. But I think having those experiences that I can go, oh yeah, like I tried that out, it didn't look good, and sitting with it and adjusting and tweaking, I think happens in the space. And so I'm very grateful when I can, you know, have work that can stay up for longer than a week. You know, I think sometimes in grad school, or like, you know, you get one night and you're like sleep deprived. And so having more time to install, I think, you know, we're giving ourselves a week to install, which is nice. So we can come in and make shifts and changes and play with things that work and don't work. That happens. I think it's very nice to be able to have that time.
Sure.
It is. I will say it is a rush. You know, it's a lot of coffee and, you know.
Like, sure.
Yeah.
No, it's the artist's way, right? I mean, you could have had this on the books for a year and it's still going to kind of be this event, you know, that you're working away towards right up until the end, kind of moving things around, kind of seeing that space. And, you know, of course, remind everybody too, where is this going to be at so they can check it out or see images if they want to kind of see?
This is at Grizzly Grizzly in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's in the 319 building in North Chinatown North. And it's a hub of artist galleries and artist run spaces. And Grizzly Grizzly is a part of that building.
And then when is that?
So it's at Grizzly Grizzly, June 6th to July 27th. So
awesome.
Check it out.
Well, that's really great. I mean, again, you know, that's one of the things that's so fun about, you know, being an artist. You know, obviously we can kind of drive ourselves nuts and then, you know, eventually we have this show to kind of hopefully resonate with other people and to kind of see it and to experience it. I would imagine just because, you know, maybe you're in the middle of your doctorate anyways, but I would imagine there's all sorts of things coming up. What other things are coming up in the future for you?
A lot of my work expands on not just making installations and, you know, things. I also have a social practice project. And so that is a way in which I can connect folks to queer history and queer research. And so, and also navigate themes of mental health and mental health awareness. And so I call it a bug making sewing circle, but folks often reflect on a time that they felt squashed like a bug and what gave them wings to keep going. And so these bugs were not only a part of several installations that I had, but the archive has grown over the last 7 years or now 8 years. And I am showing that work also later this year. And the title of that show is called Don't Let Them Clip Your Tiny Little Insect Wings. But that will be a community arts project that is showcasing all of these archive bugs at the Massillon Museum in Massillon, Ohio in October. And TBD on the dates of that, but I'm grateful that my practice has been able to kind of blend audiences. And so not just thinking about gallery white cube spaces and, you know, but also communities and multi-generational spaces where folks can come together and children can make with adults and grandparents. And so the bugs will not be in the show at Grizzly Grizzly because they're going to be for their own thing. But the bugs have been a way as I kind of navigate hard themes like ghost and death. The bugs were kind of a way to not only connect folks to community that were in community history of thinking about the AIDS Memorial Quilt or the queer women that were supporting many of the gay men who were dying, but also thinking about this like this mantra of like, keep going, keep fighting, don't forget yourself, that many queer campaigns have continued to do, which is kind of awful. If I say that, it's like we have to keep reminding ourselves that we're valid and that we matter. And I'm here to say we're valid and we matter. Keep fighting, but especially in this political climate that we are in, as it attacks, you know, trans people and queers of color for just existing. I think these messages of you matter and you're important are still really important. And so I just wish we didn't have to keep returning to them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's especially important in the times that we're in, you know, and likewise, it's cool to kind of think of all the ways that you're trying to engage with people and to stay connected with people and to talk about these things that are, you know, very important. And, you know, especially for those that want to kind of follow along, where are the best places to kind of see what you're up to and check in with all of that?
So everything is Eric Anthony Burtis, my Instagram, my website, my email, they're all Eric Anthony Burtis. And yeah, I encourage you to start there and follow along.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been great talking to you and learning more about you and your work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks once again to Eric for joining me. Please check out his website, ericanthonyburtis.com, and follow on Instagram. You can also see the two-person exhibition with Soso Capaldi, Entity Cramming, that runs through July 27th at Grizzly Grizzly in Philadelphia. We have a lot going on at Studio Break and Studio Break Gallery. Currently on view is Saccharine Dreams' My Soul exhibition of paintings that runs through July 5th. If you want to see works in the show, look under the gallery tab. All that work is available, and you can also DM me to set up an appointment or with any inquiries. Please take a second to grab that calendar, date book, or digital calendar, circle July 12th, and write Studio Break Invitational. Again, that's the night that our Studio Break Invitational opens. It was curated by Mark Mitchell of University of Arkansas, a great artist and curator, has selected 20 artists to be in this exhibition from all around the country. The list of artists includes April Beinecke, Harvey Bayless, Amelia Carley, Jeffrey Cortland Jones, Raina Frankel, Jody Hayes, Lily Hollanden, Rachel Hausman-Shaw, Toby Kaufman Buhler, Amanda Lechner, Katie Neese, Nikki Painter, Anthony Parkasic, Abby Peters, Jolene Powell, Rachel Prinz, Chris Schultz, Rachel Simonsky, Yair Sikowski, and Megan Wolfkill. You can find all the information on our Studio Break Gallery page. Opening right before that is the Impressions print show that's at Main Street Gallery in downtown West Chicago, a mere 5 minutes. I had the pleasure of co-curating that with Buddy Pumbly. And again, there's going to be over 20 artists from all around the country in that. Please do a solid and give a follow to Main Street Gallery West Chicago. And of course, check out that show from 4 to 7 on July 12th. And then come on over to Studio Break Gallery to see the Studio Break Invitational July 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. Please check out our archived episodes on StudioBreak.com. All the podcasts that you missed out on, consider subscribing on Spotify, Apple, wherever your podcasts. Music for today's episode is by Golden Shadow, which features myself, Ben Cohan, and Brett Beery. You can check out Ben's paintings by following him on Instagram at mbencohanstudio. Please follow at Brett Beery on Instagram as well. He is a musician and a producer. He runs Typical Stereo Records out of Central Illinois at Typical Stereo Records on Bandcamp. If you want to see my recent paintings, you can check out Saccharine Dreams on the gallery page. Once again, that show is up through July 5th. And if you happen to pick anything up, you help keep the lights on here at Studio Break Gallery and help me to bring all these great artists here and to create this community that I love so much. Give me a follow at Dave Linaway everywhere. And of course, you can like Studio Break's Facebook page. And of course, follow us, say hello to @studio_break on Instagram.
Hope everyone is crushing it out there and making great work, staying healthy. We'll talk to you real soon.